For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, Father, it's a weird thing to take a subject that is sort of taboo and that people don't talk about in polite conversation and make it the main topic in church on Sunday morning. But your word's that way. You want to talk to us about things that really matter in our lives and in things that are deeply relevant in our culture right now. I just pray, God, that you'll help us to cling to your word, how you'll help us to think deeply about the choices that we make in life and why they matter. I pray, God, that this wouldn't be about making people feel embarrassed or shamed or guilty, but it would be about making people understand what you say living a good life is all about. We do not want to live normal lives. We want to live exceptional lives. We want to have exceptional marriages. We want to have exceptional relationships. We want to be exceptional parents. And we believe, God, that your word is the way to do that. And your power and your spirit in our lives will make that difference. So help us, God, to be humble, to be honest, and to understand your truth and your ways about how to live. In Jesus' name, amen. Yeah, so we've been doing this Proverbs series, and it's all been wrapped up under this thing of fatherly advice. The iconic conversation where dad sits you down and he says, you know, son, I've been through this world, I've lived life, and here's some things that, you know, you can learn from me as you head out into the world. And that's really what the book of Proverbs is about. You know, there's a lot of different things in the Bible, a lot of different themes in the Bible, but the main theme of the book of Proverbs is the skill of living a good life, how to live well. Not necessarily how to get rich, not necessarily how to be comfortable, not necessarily how to avoid pain and suffering. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about living in such a way that God created you for a purpose. He has a mission for you, for me, for all of us. He had something in mind when he made us, and he made us in a certain way, along a certain lines for a reason. And as we can understand that and connect with that and embrace God's purpose for our life, we will live happier, more joy-filled, more purpose-filled lives, and that's what he, our Heavenly Father, wants for us. We talked last week about how he wants us to have a good marriage, and that part of that means having a good sex life. We talked about adultery, and we talked about the three ways to avoid adultery are one, to avoid temptation, two, to consider the consequences, but three, the most important one is have a good sex life. That if we have an exceptional marriage and an exceptional sex life with our married partner, that we will be guarded against a lot of the temptations in this world. And that's important. And we talked about adultery because adultery is such an evil trap. And it has been since the beginning of time, since the beginning of marriage. Adultery is something that you can do. You know, you make a decision to spend your life with someone. And you make a vow that I will always be faithful and that I will be here to meet your needs and you will be here to meet mine. And you build a life together and it takes trust, it takes communication, you have a home together, you start having kids, you build a life on trust and communication and you can destroy that life in an hour of indiscretion. With a few misplaced choices, you can bring down decades of intimacy and a marriage. And so adultery is one of these huge traps that our Heavenly Father wants us to avoid. He doesn't want divorce. He doesn't want betrayal. He wants unity in the home between mom and dad and unity between mom, dad, and the kids. And adultery destroys that. And then we got to the end of that discussion on adultery, and we got to the point where we were like, okay, well, where does porno fit into this? Because that's something that a lot of people wonder about. Is porno adultery? And we talked about, well, adultery is a denial of God's provision. Porn is a denial of God's provision. We're looking for our needs elsewhere. God's provided for us a spouse. We're looking to get our needs met elsewhere. It's a violation of marital vows. I will only be for you. You will only be for me. Both are a betrayal of the spouse. Both are gratifying our desires from an illegitimate source. And so is porn and adultery, are they one and the same? When we look at it from that standpoint, they have a lot of the same problems. But then we might look at it from another standpoint and say, well, there's no immediate risk of pregnancy with adultery or with pornography, which is true. Although pornography can and does lead to adultery and sexual indiscretion in many different ways, typically you're not going to get your computer pregnant. There's no immediate risk of disease. That's true as well. So it's different in that regard. More importantly, probably from a biblical standpoint, is you're not going to become one flesh with your computer. The Bible says that sex is so powerful, is so amazing in the way that it was created by God, that it binds us together as husband and wife. And that the idea behind it is that it creates the two become one flesh, and it's this incredibly unifying thing. And when you have adultery, it warns us that you are binding yourself to someone other than your wife. And with pornography, clearly you're not doing that. So there is a difference between pornography and adultery. On the other hand, we do have Jesus who said, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And what is pornography if not looking at a woman or a man with lust in your heart? So Jesus kind of comes in and trumps this entire debate. As far as God is concerned, pornography, lusting after someone who's not your spouse, is the same as adultery in terms of what's going on in the heart. And that's significant. And so when we look at, you know, we have this question, did they even have to deal with porno in Solomon's time at the time of the writing of the book of Proverbs? And that's a good question. Technology was not quite what it was back then. The arts were in their infancy stages. They tried to have pornography. So what does it mean then? How do we understand? Does the Bible have anything to say to us about pornography? Well, understanding pornography as adultery and understanding the way that the book of Proverbs talks about a specific type of adultery with prostitution and alluring men into traps, I think we get a lot of wisdom and we see that the Bible does have a lot to say about this. Let's start in Proverbs 7. It says, "Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your intimate friend, that they may keep you from an adulteress, from the foreigner who flatters with her words." Each of these sections that we talk about from Proverbs starts with this idea of value the wisdom of God. Deeply embrace God's truth, that God has a way, he has an understanding, he has a perspective that will serve you well in your life. And don't treat this profanely. As we talk about God's wisdom here, don't just let these words fly in one ear and out the other. But take the time to really think about what God is saying here, because he loves you, he loves his children, and he wants them to live good lives. They didn't have pornography the way that we have it today in the ancient world, but they did have prostitution in a way that we don't have it today. See, today in our culture, pornography is considered to be culturally acceptable. It's kind of normal. You're kind of a rapscallion if you do it, but our kids do it. Our husbands and even our wives do it, and it's not really cool to talk about it, but it's commonly accepted that this is the normal way that Americans live. Well, that's what prostitution was like in the ancient world. A widely acceptable social form of pagan worship was prostitution. Women who were impoverished were forced into the sex trade because of their poverty. And the way that it commonly worked in the ancient world is if you were from a family that was so poor that you would not be able to attract a husband for one of your daughters, you would sell your daughter when she came of age, which by the way was about 12 years old, to a temple. And she would become a priestess, for example, of the temple of Aphrodite. And she would be sold as a sex slave. Her virginity would be sold on the open market to the highest bidder. And after her virginity was taken from her, then she would be available as a priestess to whatever goddess or whatever temple it was involved in. And they would take these girls, these children, and they would put thick sandaled shoes on them so that they would clop as they walked down the cobble streets. And that sound was the trigger to the men in the culture, the call that a prostitute was coming, and they would hear the clop, 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 and it would be like the call, "Come on, boys, dinner bell." And often they would have inscribed on their feet the words "follow" and the words "me." And they would, these 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old girls would go out into the street. They were sex slaves, and they would
be inviting people to come to worship. And worship would be giving the temple owners money in order to sleep with the child priestess, and that this was considered an act of worship, a religious act of service. And it was commonly accepted that married men would do this. And this was sort of normal in the culture at the time of Solomon's writing. And so if we boil this down, what you have is a lucrative business at great expense to all involved, capitalizing on women, on girls who are in dire straits, who have nowhere else to go, run by what is essentially a kingpin crime syndicate, the temple owners, using men's sexual desire to entrap them, to bring them in, to perpetuate the problems in their marriages, but to do so while extracting a dollar price. Well, that's just like the pornography of our day, isn't it? Using underprivileged, desperate women to entice men, to make more wicked men rich. Very similar in almost all regards. And so we look at this industry, we look at this from the standpoint of Proverbs, and he has quite a lot to say about it. He has a little story. He says, "For at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive and discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense." So he's saying, I looked out my window and I saw a typical young man. And passing through the street near her corner, and he takes away the way to her house. And in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness, and behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart, and she is boisterous and rebellious, and her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. So she seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face, she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings today. Today I have paid my vows. So this young, naive boy who doesn't know any better encounters this woman who's out in the streets looking for a victim. And she is boisterous, and she's busty, and she's claiming, you know, basically she's saying, I just had all my sins cleansed, and I'm ready to add to the list. And therefore, I have come to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, with colored linens of Egypt, and I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey, and he has taken a bag of money with him, and at full moon he will come home. I mean, that might not seem like that lurid speech to us in our culture today, but it's still pretty hot. You know, she's got her bed ready. She's like, I got good smelling stuff. Everything's colorful. My husband's gone away. What we have here is, you know, a really hot environment I've set up for you. And she's enticing a naive, foolish boy who doesn't know better about the way that the world works, who doesn't have an understanding about the way that sex works. And she's set a trap for him. This brazen woman with an enticing story. You know, he just thinks, wow, I just must be really attractive. She's picked me. Aren't I the lucky one? And she's offering him a thrilling night of no consequence, a time of fleshly indulgence. She doesn't want to get married. She's already married. She doesn't want anything from him other than a good time. And read what happens. He says, with her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. Suddenly, he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver as a bird hastens to the snare. She was not offering sex to him. She was a decoy to lure him into an alley where he could be murdered and robbed. That was the whole point of the whole exercise. But it says, like an ox to the slaughter, you know, she's come with her buxom story and her enticements, and she's claimed to have this inconsequential sexual tryst. And he's just like a cow to the slaughter. Moo, whatever you say, that sounds awesome. And what's waiting is ambush and death. So he does not know that it will cost him his life. Now, therefore, my son, listen to me. Listen and pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways, and do not stray into her path. For many are the victims she has cast down, and numerous are all her slain. Her house is the way to the grave, descending to the chamber of death. Young, naive boy, as you grow up in this world, do not take this offer, this enticement of something for nothing, of consequence-free sex. Do not take it, do not believe it, because it will lead you to death. It's a trap. A beautiful woman used to trap and rob the naive with an enticing story, an unrealistic offer, leading the naive to their doom. This is the trap that he's talking about. It's just changed in its intricacies. It's changed in its form. But it operates along exactly the same principles as of temple prostitution, of enticing naive young men into consequence-free sex that ends in their destruction. It is exactly the same. Porn in America is an incredible institution. You know, there's a lot of statistics that have been thrown out there about this. A lot of them are wrong. There's a lot of misinformation out there. A lot of it coming from Christians. A lot of it coming from internet filtering sites. So I had the pleasure this week of trying to research and establish what were actual figures for the porn industry. What I did was I went to Forbes.com and I went to USA Today and the New York Times, and I did searches to find out what the industry was really saying about pornography, the real numbers. And the best number, it's hard to track, but the best number that seems most reliable, $13 billion per year in the sex-related entertainment market. Now that is a huge number. To put that number in perspective, we took the six major studios, Disney, Fox, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Universal, Sony, and their subsidiaries. They had a total of $7.4 billion from worldwide box office sales. So porn did twice as well as those companies combined. To give you another reference point, the NFL has 32 teams. Its revenues in 2009 rose 7% to $7.6 billion. So they're making about twice what the NFL is making in porn in America. And porn is the business of entrapping naive and the foolish. Now, it can be difficult. It can be deceptive. We think, okay, $13 billion a year are going into porn. But if you're somebody who has ever used a computer, who knows anything about internet and the consequences of porn on the internet, you know there are millions upon millions of free pornography sites out there. So when we take a number like $13 billion, that's the people who are paying. That's the money that they're raking in from the people that they've gotten hooked with the free stuff. How many more hours, how many more people are being consumed by the free stuff? Well, it would behoove us, I think, to think about the draws of pornography. Why is this so interesting? Why does this have so much of the culture, especially in the United States, wrapped up in it? And the first and foremost is, frankly, it's an easy resolution to immediate sexual urges. You know, relationships are complicated. Men and women work along very different lines. They have very different ways of operating and communicating, and marriage gets complicated. And pornography enables you to get your sexual desires met without having to work on your relationship with your spouse. It's a shortcut. It's a way out. You don't have to spend the time and the energy resolving conflict. You don't have to spend the time and the energy to understand each other's needs, to talk about your day, to lay down your life and sacrifice. You can just sit there watching TV next to each other until it's time to go to bed, and then take your turn to meet your needs by yourself and live a parallel life to your spouse. And you can avoid the pain, the risk of rejection, and all that goes along with a healthy marital life. Porn is a shortcut that will kill your marriage and kill the joy in your sex life and leave you wanting more.
I think another one of the draws is just the excitement of being bad. Some people have pretty satisfying marital sex lives, but they're still drawn into pornography because it's naughty. And having an impersonal encounter with a naughty girl, this idea of getting caught and doing something shameful and taking a risk, gets the heart pumping, gets the blood flowing, and makes people get drawn into these kinds of traps. But let's think about this naughty vixen on the other end of this connection. If lust is spiritual adultery, then all porn stars are adulterers. They have decided to make their living by stumbling and enticing married men and married women into lusting after them. And who are they? Who are these people who are exciting us and enticing us so much? Well, we can go to Proverbs 6 and we can learn a little bit more about the adulterous heart. My son, observe the commandment of your father and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. Again, listen to how important this is. And when you awake, they will talk to you, for the commandment is a lamp and the teaching is a light, and reproofs for discipline are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. And do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? That is very interesting right there. What are you to the person you're lusting after? And this pornographic relationship that you're initiating through your computer, who are the players? Well, there's you. You are the one who is reducing the person on the other end to an impersonal object. And we all have heard about that. We understand that. You're taking someone who is magnificent and wonderful, created in the image of God, as damaged as they may be, as troubled as they may be, and you are reducing them to a sexual object in your mind. Bad. That's a bad thing to do. But who are you to them? You're a loaf of bread. They're taking you, a wonderfully created in the image of God, amazing person, and turning your sexual sin into a meal ticket, into putting food on their table. You've been reduced to a loaf of bread. She's been reduced to a sexual object. And God is grieved because his children abuse one another and treat them with far less respect, far less dignity than they deserve. An adulteress hunts for the precious life. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? Now, maybe you're sitting there and you're thinking, well, I don't mind. That sounds like a fair deal to me. I'll turn her into a sexual object. She can turn me into a loaf of bread, and we'll all be happy. Well, let me suggest that you're a fool, if that's what you think. Because there is a lot more at work here. There is a lot more at the heart of this, that we have to open our hearts and our minds to understanding that what we do when we reduce God's children to objects is that we deny the existence, we deny the importance of who we are as a race, and we disrespect our Creator who has done incredible things for us. Which leads us to our next point, the idea that this is an illusion, that this is a victimless sin. You know, it's enticing because, well, you know, it might screw up my thought life for a while. It'll make my wife mad if she finds out. I can keep that consequence by keeping her in the dark on this issue. And really, it's a victimless crime. I get a little break, a little me time, a little excitement in my life, and no one gets hurt. But let's break down exactly what's happening here. A beautiful girl created in the image of God with an incredible body who's designed in such a way that we are supposed to be looking at and saying, isn't God amazing in what he can do and what he can create and the way that he can create the human form? A woman who reflects the beauty and power of God's creation comes into the world, and she is abused, she is used, she is demeaned. She is treated like an object from the youngest stages of her life. And she's no longer now valuable in her own eyes.
She no longer sees the spark of the image of God in her own life. She has been reduced to a piece of meat. And in her thinking and her rationale through her damaged life, she has decided, well, if I'm going to be meat, I might as well be meat that makes money. And she uses her body to make money and draw people in. And you and I and everyone else who has ever gotten into pornography comes along and proves her right with every click of the mouse. Every time, I don't care if you've ever put your credit card money down or not, but every time you click on one of these sites, you're recorded as a visitor, as a hit. They don't know who you are necessarily, but they know that you're watching, and they know that what they're putting out there and what they're doing to this girl and what they're allowing this girl to do to herself works. And so we become part of the problem, not an innocent bystander, not a part of a victimless crime, but a part of a system that is destroying God's daughters and tearing down the value of what it means to be a child of God. Mark Driscoll wrote an interesting book that talks about this. It's called Porn Again Christian. I recommend it. This is one of the better books on this subject. You know, Driscoll he's very direct, he's very frank. But I think this book has some value. I want to share with you a story from the book. He says, while on a radio program, a male caller was speaking about his enslavement to pornography and how he didn't feel too badly about his sin because the women in the magazines were getting paid and probably had fun being sex objects. That's what we tell ourselves. They like this. That this is like some kind of naughty vixen who's getting rich by doing something she loves. During the commercial break, a young woman from my church who was working for the radio show came in to say hello and ended up telling me her story. She explained that she had been repeatedly sexually abused by her uncle as a young girl and came to see herself as a dirty girl. She embraced her filth and became a very promiscuous young woman who had sex with older men. When she was old enough, she began stripping at a seedy club, and because of her beautiful body, she made piles of money and was soon solicited by men for prostitution, which she obliged to make even greater sums of money. Since an older man had abused her for so many years, it made sense in her mind to at least pay her bills from the act. Eventually, she was offered a job as a porn star and began making adult films. But the entire industry was so sickening, degrading, and animalistic that she would have to get high and drunk before each movie shoot just to endure the violations. She then explained to me that none of this stopped until she met Jesus Christ. As she spoke, I couldn't help but wonder if there were men from my church out renting her videos to take home and masturbate to without knowing that she would be sitting in church next to them and singing songs to Jesus the following Sunday. Indeed, God's men should treat every woman in the same way we would treat our sisters. That's the experience of these women. These naughty girls that we think are having fun have been taught that they are meat. They are women from poor backgrounds who are trying to use what they think that they have, which is a hot body, a sexual mindset, and trying to use it to take advantage and get ahead so that they can feed their drug problems, they can feed their alcohol issues, and that they can put food on their table. And this is what we are participating in when we participate innocently or seemingly innocently, even in the non-pay stuff that's online. Maybe another thing that we think about this, you know, as we try to justify this behavior in our own minds is we think this is normal in our culture. Why are we even talking about this? I know and you know that most people out there in the world, most people out there in America, they will say if asked in public, is porn bad? They will say yes, but then they go home and do it. And it's proper to say it's bad, but to do it, and most people actually are involved in doing it, engaging and looking at pornographic material, that $13 billion comes from somewhere. Not to mention all the free stuff, not to mention all the stuff that's not even technically considered pornography, but is. So it's normal. Why do Christians have to get their undies in a bunch about this? Why can't we just have it be secret and on the side? The reason is here in Proverbs 7, for many are the victims she has cast down, and numerous are all her slain. Her house is the way to Sheol, descending to the chambers of death. Just because the vast majority of the culture is destroying their minds and their souls and their marriages with poison doesn't mean that we should be poisoning ourselves. We should be striving for a little bit more than what is considered normal in our culture. Porn is normal in our culture. If you're looking at porn, you're doing the normal thing that normal people do in America. But the other things that are normal that people do in America is have crappy marriages. That's normal too. Divorce is normal in our culture. And so if we want to be like everyone else, adultery is also normal in our culture. And oh, by the way, dying alone and looking back over your life with bitterness and regret, that's normal in America too. Let's think about this for a minute and think about, do we want to be normal or do we want to be exceptional? God is your creator, as your father who loves you, who put his image, who created you in such a way that you reflect his glory, does not want you to settle for normal. We shouldn't have normal marriages. You shouldn't be normal wives. You shouldn't be normal husbands. You should be exceptional. Normal is not good enough. Normal doesn't glorify God. Normal doesn't set us apart from a broken culture. God forbid that we have normal lives. God forbid that we be normal parents. God forbid that someone look at your life and say, there's a normal Joe, there's a normal Jane. That is not what we were built for. That is not why we're here. We are here to be the glory of God on earth. The children of God and the person of Jesus Christ, unified, glorified as a community. We are supposed to be a light on a hill, shining the love of God and the truth of God into a culture of darkness that is lost, that is poisoning itself with things like pornography. And we are supposed to stand out against that. The fact that it's normal means nothing. Because we don't want normal lives. We want exceptional lives for our children, for our spouses, for our friends, and for our neighbors. Another excuse that we might use is we might think, I've got it under control. Yes, this is an area where I struggle. Yes, Ryan, thank you very much. I already feel guilty enough about this. I don't need to feel more guilty today. Thank you. That might be how we're feeling right now. And I understand that. But I'm not here to make you feel guilty. I'm not here to heap on coals. I know that your guilt will not cause you to change your behavior. God knows that. What I'm here to do is to try to help you to see that there is an exceptional life that God wants you to have. And if you're suffering in silence and you are somebody who has gone to this well of poison again and again and promised yourself that was the last time, and no one in your life knows what's really going on with you and the trap that you're really in, and you keep telling yourself, I can fix this, I am big enough, I am strong enough, and I can overcome this, and you go back to it again and again and again, then you are right here in this proverb. You are the naive boy who's gone down the alley and you are about to be pierced by the arrow through your liver. Because you do not know that this will cost you your life. You are in danger. And it is time to stop being the naive fool and to grow and become a man of God who lives in the light and bears his shame and repents from his sin. Here's a question. If it's so under control, then why not just stop? Why not just never do it again? If you've been telling yourself it's under control, and I'm going to stop, and you keep going back again and again, guess what? It's not under control. Sin, all sin, has an enslaving aspect. We've talked about the economy of diminishing returns here many times. You get into something that's bad for you. It makes you feel good. It fills a need for a short time, but it doesn't fill it in a permanent way, and it leaves you feeling worse than before. So you've got to go back and get more. It works this way with heroin. It works this way with alcohol. It works this way with relationships. It works this way with shopping. And it works this way with sex.
I give myself over to a depraved version of something that God created as good, and I dig myself into a hole, and I find myself feeling more needy and needing more and more drastic decisions on my part in order to cover up my mistakes. 2 Peter 2 describes it perfectly. It says, "For speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved." God does not want his children to live in slavery. He wants us to live in freedom. Addiction is slavery in all of its forms. And will cause damage in our lives to varying degrees. And people get into pornography and they think it's no big deal and they think this is what everybody does and they think, you know, this is just an innocent way of relieving tension in my life, and then they need more and they need more intense and they need more graphic depictions, and they start down a slippery slope that leads them ultimately to their demise. Nobody knows this better than Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy, the murderer and rapist of over 30 women. In the last night of his life before he was executed by the state, Charles Dobson did an interview with him. It's about a half hour long. I've cut it down to about 3 minutes just so you can get the main points. But listen to what Ted Bundy, to his legacy and what he says.
Ted, how did it happen? Take me back. What are the antecedents of the behavior that we've seen? So much grief, so much sorrow, so much pain for so many people. Where did it start? How did this moment come about?
What happened? I think this is the message I want to get across. But as a young boy, and I mean a boy of 12 or 13, certainly, that I encountered outside the home again, the local grocery store, the local drug store, the softcore pornography, what people call softcore. But as I think I explained to you last night, Dr. Dobson, in an anecdote, as young boys do, we explored the back roads and sideways and byways of our neighborhood, and oftentimes people would dump the garbage and whatever they were cleaning out of their house, and from time to time we'd come across pornographic books of a harder nature than graphic, you might say, more explicit nature than we would encounter, let's say, in your local grocery store. And this also included such things as, let's say, detective magazines and more
harsh. Those that involve violence.
Yes. And I this is something I think I want to emphasize, is the most damaging kinds of pornography, and I'm talking from personal experience. Listen, I'm no social scientist, and I haven't done a survey. I mean, I don't pretend that I know what John Q. Citizen thinks about this. But I've lived in prison for a long time now, and I've met a lot of men who were motivated to commit violence just like me, and without exception, every one of them was deeply involved in pornography, without question, without exception, deeply influenced and consumed by an addiction to pornography. There's no question about it. The FBI's own study on serial homicide shows that the most common interest among serial killers is pornography.
It's a pretty interesting full interview. You know, he says in there, and it's important to note, what he says is, he says, you know, pornography didn't cause me to become a serial killer and a rapist. What he says is, it fed the part of me that was inclined in that direction. And, you know, Ted Bundy was operating in a time before the internet. But listen, remember what he said. He said, it started with, there were, you know, the softcore stuff in the magazine rack at the grocery store and the drugstore. And then me and my friends, we would search the neighborhood, and people would throw out some harder core stuff, and that there's a progression of what was going on in his heart and in his life, and this was feeding that. And his point is not, if you get into pornography, you're going to become a serial killer. We all know that that's not true. The recipe for that soup is a little more complicated than that. But what is true is that whatever entry point we begin, there is a slope that is downhill. And many of us will go down that hill, will go down that slope and find different destinations, but all of them are destructive. All of them will cause us and push us into areas that we would not have otherwise gone if we hadn't gone to get these needs met from a place that was a well of poison. And that's what we need to understand, is that people get addicted to porn. This is proven. It is just as addictive as nicotine and alcohol and drugs. It causes endorphin release in your brains. It puts deep neural pathways through your brain that cause you to want to go back and get the same fix chemically from your own brain as any other drug. And that people get hooked on this and it destroys their lives, it perverts their thinking, and it leaves them in ruin. They follow that buxom young girl down that alley and they get shot right in the liver. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? It's a rhetorical question. Of course not. And you cannot play with fire and you cannot play with pornography without hurting yourself and without hurting the people you love. Proactive steps that we can take here: get help. Do not suffer in this alone. If you're toe dangling, you're doing the thing where you're searching your spam box for stuff that your filter might have, you know, taken out just to wonder what's there. Or if you're looking on the internet, if you're on the internet at 3 o'clock in the morning by yourself, you're asking for trouble, period. You know, oh, well, I just go and I check out the Sports Illustrated, you know, swimsuit edition. They're fully clothed. I don't have a problem. That's a problem. You're leading, you're going and you're looking to get your needs met from somewhere other than your spouse. Pornography can take on many different masks. It could be a chat conversation. It can be a romance novel, ladies. It can be wherever you go other than your spouse to get your sexual desires met. Softcore, hardcore, it doesn't matter. Those delineations are in our mind in order to justify our sinful behavior. Don't suffer alone thinking you've got it under control. Bring in some help. Here's a popular one. Talk to your spouse. You know how hard it is to get a man to talk to his wife about what's really going on in his thought life? It's super hard. It's super difficult. To get to the heart of the unmet needs and work on the issues together. You know, if you're struggling with pornography as a woman or as a man, it means that there's a need that's unmet in your life. And if your spouse is a godly person who loves you and is wanting to lay down their life for you, they want to know that you have unmet needs. They may not know and they may not be willing to meet whatever those needs are. But they will want to communicate and know and work together to figure out what's going on and what's broken in your life. Your spouse is the right person to fight this battle with. Now, a lot of you guys are sitting there and you're thinking, yeah, I tried that once and I will never do that again, because your wife exploded. Your wife was so hurt, was so devastated, was so rocked by your betrayal that she taught you and she made it clear that that's never what you were to do again. And so you've kept it going, but you've not confessed it. And let me speak to the wives here and let me suggest something. You need to be a proactive listener. It's a well-known adage in our culture that men have two brains. One of them lives up here and the other one doesn't, right? We'll call that one his man brain. And his man brain is telling him not to come talk to you because it'll be shameful, because it'll hurt you, and because it'll make it harder to sin in the future. His man brain is telling him that if he goes to you and stands up as a man in integrity and says that I have failed you as a husband, that you are going to punish him and his needs are going to go even more unmet than they were going before. And if he comes to you, he is operating not under his man brain, but under his God-given human rationale. And he is standing up as a man of integrity to tell you and to repent to you that he has failed. And you have got a good man because you know he's in the fight. Virtually every man you know struggles with this. And if yours is coming to you to confess, he is in the fight. And he's coming to you despite his shame, despite his failure, despite every reason that he has, every reason that his man brain is telling him not to, because he's a man of integrity and a man of God. Now, does that mean that your reaction should be, oh, I'm so happy that you've confessed this terrible betrayal? No, it's okay to be hurt. It's okay to be upset. But do not, for the sake of your marriage, do not teach him, I don't want to know when you do this. This hurts me too deeply for you to be honest with me. Because you are then sealing the tomb on your husband's sin and entrapping him, encasing him forever on his own. Because what you are telling him is, this is too painful for me to allow you to be real about your struggles. And I will punish you too harshly. It's not going to make him stop. It's going to make him alienated and isolated. And you don't want that. And let me suggest to you that if you're sitting there and you realize that's exactly what you've done with your husband, you've got to go crack the lid on that crypt. And you've got to go back to him and say, I responded poorly. And I want you to be honest with me. And I can't promise that I'll respond the right way every time. But I want a godly marriage. I want an exceptional marriage. And I want to have the kind of marriage where you can come to me and you can say, honey, I'm struggling with lust. Will you pray for me? And I can know that you're a man of God, a man of integrity, and that I can pray with you about what you're suffering through. That's what we need in our marriages, is we need honesty. And we need the ability to talk forthrightly about what's really happening and where our needs are really going unmet. Get an accountability partner. Get somebody who's in the fight with you to talk to and to ask you real and specific questions. Here's how bad accountability partner relationships go. You get together and you say, so, how was your week? And they say, pretty good. And they say, glad to hear it. You've learned nothing there. And this is an area of shame. This is an area of hardship. And you have to ask a question that's specific enough that you're either going to get a lie or the truth from somebody and nothing in between. So saying, how was your week? Or have you been struggling? Are not good enough questions. A good enough question is, have you been lusting in your heart after anyone other than your wife this week? That's a question that you can bank on. Have you been toe dangling? Have you been struggling with pornography? Have you been on the net and doing things that you're ashamed of? Is there anything on your heart right now that you're really hoping I won't ask? Those are the kinds of questions that you want to ask, and those are the questions that you will ask if you love your brother or your sister that you're trying to keep accountable. And they will ask you those same questions because they love you, and they don't want you to suffer alone. Here's one that's really important. Educate your kids. I don't know what would happen if I was raised today with the amount of access and the amount of acceptability in our culture on this issue. I think it would have destroyed my life. And it terrifies me to think of my 10-year-old son and my 8-year-old daughter being raised in a world where everybody's got pornography in their pocket. But we have got to win this battle with our kids. We have got to fight. We have got to help them to learn to grow up in a world that is sick with this poison, and to live in that world, to not be shut off from that world, but not to fall down this trap and to have their livers pierced with the arrow of pornography. My son's 10 years old, and we've had very frank talks because he's got friends on the bus with smartphones. You cannot eliminate, you no longer in any way can protect your family or your children from exposure to this kind of material. It's impossible. You would have to completely wall them off and keep them from having any other relationships in the world, which is absolutely against what God wants for us. We are to be in the world, according to God, but not of the world. So the only way to teach our children how to navigate through the milieu, through the environment that they are going to face, whether your kids are 14 or whether they're 2, is to teach them the wisdom of God and to be men and women and children of character and to teach them that that the world and their friends will say that this is no big deal, that this is okay, that this is normal. But for them to see that the Word of God says this is poison that's going to break their hearts and damage their marriages. And our kids need us to be examples. Examples who will talk to them about our own personal failures, the pain in our lives that has been created by our sexual poor choices, and to be examples of people who are in the fight and fighting the good fight to live a life of moral integrity despite what our culture says is acceptable or unacceptable. That's what our children need. That is the only way they are going to make it, is by us leading the way with God's wisdom, having real talks. We can take steps, no computers in private places. I think that's a great idea. But that, again, is a bandage. That's not going to get to the heart of the issue. Filtering software is good. It gives you a moment of pause before you, if you're feeling tempted and you can go into and it's just freely accessible. Yes, that's helpful to have that there, but it doesn't get to the heart of the issue. It doesn't get to the unmet needs and the understanding of how powerful human sexuality is. Talk with your kids and don't turn a blind eye. Don't teach your kids that you don't want to hear about and you don't want to know about their problems in this area. Be a proactive listener there as well. Resources. This site I hadn't had the opportunity to check out a lot. It's called pureintimacy.org. It's where I got the Ted Bundy interview from, but it seemed kind of cool. I'm going to look for more resources there. So I can't endorse it wholeheartedly, but you might check that out. Triple X Church is another interesting organization. They're actually trying to help people who are addicted to pornography get off. And they're also helping people who are in the porn industry, reaching out to them with the love of Jesus Christ. I don't know how they're doing it, but they are doing it, which is great. We have classes here that are helpful, sexual integrity for men and sexual integrity for women. Courses that help people who are struggling in this area or who just want to be able to help other people who are struggling in this area get some understanding about more of the biblical concepts that we're talking about here. And again, I would recommend, there have been a number of books published on this topic. I think that we're going to see a lot more. There's really not enough published on this topic. But this book by Driscoll, I think, is one of the more helpful books that I would recommend. So there you have Proverbs on adultery and porno.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.